Welcome. What an inspiring conference so far. Do I speak for everybody in that thought and reflection? Wow. What a gift today is for all of us. My name is Shannon Rosetich, and I'm thrilled to be your MC for this session. This is going to be an incredibly inspiring hour for all of us. I am incredibly proud to be a part of this conference, as is my company, Sanofi, to be a conference sponsor. There is information about Sanofi at your seats. We are a global leading biopharmaceutical company that is focused on advancing human health. We also make diversity and inclusion a top priority for our organization. I am proud to say that in the state of Massachusetts, we are one of the largest employers in the healthcare field, and we were named one of the top 100 companies to work for by Working Mother magazine this year. We also are proud that we put women in leadership positions. In the U.S., 65% of our revenue is led by female executives, including myself. I have the honor of being the North American lead for Sanofi Genzyme's rare disease business unit. Thank you. Within my unit, we focused on bringing life-saving therapies to patients with rare conditions and specialty disabilities. We also are proud to be part of the Massachusetts Movement for Diversity and Inclusion. I'm honored to be the MC for today. We're going to have a very inspiring session. This is a personal passion for me, not only as a female in the workforce, but also as a mother of daughters and of one son. Gender diversity is something that is a journey for all of us. We are making strides, but we're not where we need to be. I've had the privilege of serving on the board of directors for Healthcare Business Women's Association. This year, I'm the chair of that board, and we're making a concerted effort on a variety of levels to make an impact on moving the gender equality needle. This is going to be a very inspiring session. It is my honor to welcome our keynote speaker, Fran Hauser. Fran is a longtime media executive. She's a startup investor, and she is the author of the book, The Myth of the Nice Girl. She has held senior positions at some of the world's largest media businesses, including People, InStyle, Entertainment Weekly, as well as AOL and MoviePhone. She is here today with us on the last day of her seven-month book tour. We are honored to have her here, and we'd like to congratulate her that her book, The Myth of the Nice Girl, was just named the top business book of 2018. She has a very inspiring talk for us and guidance on how we can use our kindness and humanity as a strength. Please welcome Fran to the stage.
Hi, everyone. It's so great to be here. So this is it. This is the last session, right, of the day? And I was saying to Shannon, I am a little bit emotional. You know, I've been on this book tour for 7 months since April. I've done over 60 talks. I've been all around the country. And I'm so excited to be here with all of you today. And the recognition that Shannon mentioned was just yesterday I found out that Audible named the book the top business book of 2018, and it also made Amazon's list of the best business and leadership books for 2018, too. So it's so incredibly exciting and rewarding to see how this message is resonating. How to be a great boss and colleague and stay human is a topic that I'm really passionate about, and it's something that I've been thinking about, you know, for a long time. In fact, the question that I've been asked the most over the course of my career is, how can you be so nice and still be successful? Now, niceness at work often gets equated with weakness. And if you're too nice, you're not going to get to the corner office, whatever the corner office might mean to you. Obviously, I don't buy that. I think that being nice, being human, bringing all of that to work has served me really well in my career. For the simple reason that when you're nice to people at work, it allows you to build trust and to develop relationships. And at the end of the day, being successful in business is all about relationships. So I have an example of this for you, my first big promotion. I was 26 years old. I was working at Coca-Cola Enterprises, and I was promoted to the controller position for the New York division, which is a $500 million division, and I was going to be overseeing 40 people, which that was a big deal for me. I went from overseeing one person by the name of John Mitchell to overseeing 40 people, and I wasn't the logical choice for this role. Like, it's funny, I just reconnected with my boss, Lamar Chesney, who put me in this position. And he said to me, he's like, Fran, you weren't tier one. You were definitely tier two, meaning I wasn't reporting directly into him. I was reporting like two levels down. And when I asked him why, because I was so stunned by the promotion, why me? He said for three reasons. My ability to influence others, the fact that I'd built a team that would follow me, and that I had also built a strong network and relationships. And if you notice, he didn't say anything about my technical skills, my functional skills, the harder skills. I mean, I'd like to believe that I had those too, but he really focused on the relational skills. So the truth is, nice girls kill it in the corner office. I really believe that. And then I often get asked, like, what do you mean by nice? What does it mean to be nice at work? So this is how I define someone who's nice at work. It's someone who elevates the people around her, someone who draws people in, cares deeply for others, is guided by values, and is authentically confident, has that confidence that there are enough opportunities to go around. There's actually a big difference, though, between being nice and being a people pleaser that I think we all need to be aware of, because when you veer into that people pleasing territory, that's when you can pretty easily sabotage like any chance of being successful. So it's great to be positive, but if you're sweeping things under the rug because you don't want to make waves, that's not all that productive. Being helpful will get you far. Being subservient, not so much. Being humble makes you relatable. But being self-critical, where you're constantly putting yourself down, puts you in a position of weakness. So, yes, we want to be nice and we want to be human and we want to bring all of that to work, but there really is a fine line, and we just have to be really careful that we don't cross over into that people-pleasing territory. So we interviewed over 1,500 women in the workplace for the book, and 95% of them said that they feel that being nice has been helpful to them in their career. But 76% of them feel caught in this double bind between the need to be nice and the need to be strong. And what I heard from a lot of women is that if I'm too nice, I'm thought of as a pushover, and if I'm too strong, I'm thought of as a bitch. And so what I'm here to tell you today is that you don't have to choose between being nice and being strong, or between being a great boss and colleague and staying human. And I really believe that the most effective leaders lead with both. They care about their team, and they have high expectations of them. They're really inclusive when they're making a decision, yet when they make the decision, they stand firm. They communicate in a way that's both kind and direct. So the book has many, I would say like over 100 tips and techniques and scripts that you can use. But what I wanted to do for the keynote was really surface the 10 practices that have resonated the most with readers. So what we did was we looked at all of the digital data out there on the book. We looked at the most highlighted passages in the Kindle version. We looked at social media. We looked at, LinkedIn, emails that I received directly from readers. And based on all of that data, we came up with the top 10. So here are the top 10 practices from the book. The first is to use your empathy strategically. And, empathy is something that we talk a lot about, and it's just, it's something that's so important, and there's so much power in it. You know, the ability to really try to get into the other person's head or put yourself in their shoes, when you operate at that level of empathy, it really can result in a win-win outcome for both sides. Many negotiating experts say that it's actually the single most important factor when you're negotiating is to be able to put yourself into the other person's shoes. William Ury, I love this quote from him, "The effective negotiators I know are excellent listeners who know how to put themselves in the other side's shoes." And I think about, you know, when I was at Time Inc. and I was working at magazines like People and in Style and Entertainment Weekly, and so often we would find ourselves in these positions where we were negotiating, you know, with another company, and it would just get stuck, you know, and the conversation wasn't going anywhere. And then I would come in, or like somebody else would come in, and just ask a simple question of the other party. Just ask, what's important to you? You know, what do you need to get out of this partnership? And then actively listen and respond. And, you know, guess what? Like, the conversation gets unstuck. Just because you're showing that you care about what's important to them and what they value and what they need to get out of it. So I just can't stress that enough. Like, from a negotiating perspective, it's so easy to kind of go into it, go into any conversation with, here are the three things that I need to get out of it, right? Because we're like, we're so busy, so I can't leave this conversation without those three things. And instead, if you flip it and if you start by understanding their side, it will naturally come back to you, you know, and it will be a win-win. Empathy, you know, you can pretty much apply empathy to any human interaction at work, not just negotiating. So if you're disagreeing with someone, you know, if you're showing that you are seeing their point of view, you're more likely to come to a shared understanding. If you're asking for a raise, you know, think about, put yourself in your manager's shoes and think about what they have to gain by retaining you. It's just, again, flipping it and looking at it from their perspective. Networking. Often we go to networking meetings and we're so focused on what we'd like to get out of it. But just asking, how can I be helpful to you, deepens the relationship and the connection. And then giving feedback. And giving feedback is actually the central theme of the second practice, which is all about communicating kindly and directly. You know, when you communicate in a way that's kind, it allows the person to actually hear what you're saying. And when you communicate in a way that's direct, they can very clearly understand the feedback or the information that you're giving them. So it really is important to do both. It's also important, like one of the things I loved about writing this book was I got to study things like how the brain works. And there's a part of our brain that's called the amygdala that is responsible for sensing threat. It can be physical threat, emotional threat, psychological threat. And when it senses threat, it triggers that fight, flight, or freeze response. So it's important to understand that when you're going to give someone tough feedback or you're doing a, you know, performance review at the end of the year, don't go into it in a way that can be construed as threatening, because they're not going to be able to process the information. And it could be your nonverbal, it could be the words that you're using. But instead, you know, the way that the best way to give empathetic feedback really is to start the conversation by saying something like, I'm your biggest champion, you know, I'm your biggest fan, I support you, I want to see you be successful in your career. If you start the dialogue in that way, as opposed to, look, we have some things we need to talk about, you know, the latter is automatically going to trigger that fight, flight, freeze. So the way you start the conversation is so important. The other thing I would say is asking questions, even if you're the one giving the feedback. When you're asking questions, if you ask a question around, you know, what do you think could have been done differently, as opposed to saying, what do you think you could have done differently? It's just one word, right? But saying, what do you think could have done differently? It broadens the conversation and it allows the person to talk to you about a variety of things that could be done differently, but hopefully they'll also talk about what they could have done differently. Be specific with the feedback. This is really important. I once had a manager who was so nice that she was trying to give me feedback And she sugarcoated it so much that it ended up being really wishy-washy. And I ended up not understanding, like, anything that I was supposed to do. So being really specific about the feedback is important. And then leaving the meeting with next steps really clear. Like, here are the three things that we're going to work on. And, you know, it's we. Like, so it's the person. They know what they need to do. But even as a manager, like, I feel like I have accountability for my team. So I had a situation where I had a head of business development who I really felt needed to kind of ramp up her network in a couple of areas. So that was the feedback that I gave her. And I told her that one of the things that I would do for her was make three introductions for her. So that was my accountability coming out of that meeting. So it's shared accountability. Another really important part of communication is speaking up. And I can't tell you like how many meetings I've sat in over the course of my career where men are speaking and women are sitting there just like waiting for an opening or agonizing over the absolute perfect thing to say. And I'm still seeing this. I'm even seeing this on the book tour. I actually spoke at a real estate investment firm about a month ago where there were men and women in the room. And when it came time for Q&A, every man raised their hand and not one woman did. And the CEO of that real estate investment firm is a woman, and she was in the room. And she actually called everybody out on it. You know, she's like, guys, do you see what just happened? Like, do you see this dynamic? Like, here I am talking about like women's empowerment and leadership and how we all need to speak up more and have a voice and all this great stuff. And not one woman raised her hand. I see the same thing at every university, every single university that I've spoken at. The men are always the first ones to raise their hands. Afterwards, the women will come up to me and ask me questions one-on-one. And I remember asking the dean of one of the business schools I spoke at, I'm like, is this normal? And he said it happens every single time. Like, it doesn't matter who's speaking, if it's a man, if it's a woman, it's the dynamic. So we need to change that, clearly. So this is something, actually, that I really struggled with very early on in my career. I am more of an introvert. And when I was maybe 2 years out of school, I was working at Ernst & Young. And Coca-Cola, actually, was our client. And we spent a lot of time at the Coca-Cola offices and in this conference room with lots of people, including our main client at Coca-Cola, who was this older, imposing, you know, intimidating man. And I just found myself, like, to be so nervous around him. And anytime he said anything, I have to pull this up. This was my response. Anytime he said anything, all that I could muster to say was a non-committal, that's interesting. Like, we could be talking about what to have for lunch. And it was like, that's it. That's interesting. So one day, I walk out of one of these meetings, and my boss, who I absolutely love to this day, Lou Sciarretta, pulled me to the side, and he said, Fran, you are so smart. You have really great thoughts and points of views about things. And that's not showing in these meetings. You're not saying anything, or you're just saying, that's interesting. So in the next meeting, like, you need to say something else. And like, he basically challenged me. He's like, you have to. And so I did. So before the next meeting, I looked at the agenda and I picked one thing that I felt really comfortable talking about. And I spoke up, and I talked about it. It wasn't anything all that sophisticated or provocative, but I said something other than that's interesting. And I have to tell you, like, the more that I did it, the more comfortable that I felt. And that older, imposing, intimidating man from Coca-Cola ended up hiring me away from Ernst & Young to work on his team. And it really changed the trajectory of my whole entire career. And if I hadn't had that, Shannon, we were talking before about mentors, right? If I hadn't had Lou, like, to care enough to take the time to say something to me, I don't know if I ever would have spoken up. And then they wouldn't have known who I was, right? So it's so important, and it's something that I think if you're somebody who doesn't have a problem with this, if you're really confident and you're gregarious and you love, you know, speaking up in meetings, look for the quiet ones in the room, you know, because if you see someone, if you see a woman who you know that they have a lot to contribute, but they're not, maybe there's a way that you can be helpful to them. You know, maybe there's a way that you can draw it out of them. I had a situation with this young woman, Sarah, where she was one of these people. And I basically just said to her, look, in the next meeting, I'm going to ask you to talk about X, Y, and Z topic because you have a really important point of view that people need to hear. And it gave her time to prepare. And I think because she prepared, then she felt more confident. And I did that with her a few times, and then she just started speaking up on her own. So if it's not something you struggle with, look around and see if you can be helpful. If it is something that you struggle with, though, here are some strategies, like what I just talked about. You know, reviewing the agenda ahead of time and preparing. Don't wait for an opening. So I had an experience once where I was in a board meeting, actually, and this great man who I have a lot of respect for, he had the floor, and he just wouldn't stop talking. And I was trying to get a word in edgewise, and it wasn't working. So I stood up. I stood up. Everybody else was sitting, and I stood up. And it forced everyone to look at me. And that's an example of, like, not waiting for the opening, right? If you have something that's really important and you see that it's, like, really difficult to get in, stand, you know, or do something else. Use some other nonverbal cue that can be helpful. The other thing I really find to be helpful, have your stock phrases ready to kind of insert yourself into the conversation. It could be following on that, or I love that perspective, and, or, you know, building on that. Because what it does is it just gets you started, you know? It gets you started. My writing partner interviewed a lot of my colleagues for the book because she wanted to understand very specific techniques that I used, specifically communication techniques. And one of the things that a handful of people said about me, which I didn't realize that I did this, but now it makes sense to me. They said that what I do is I repeat like half of their sentence, like the last half of their sentence, and then I add on to it. It made them feel really heard. You know, it made them feel like, okay, she's really listening to me. But I think the reason I do it is because it gives me a little bit of a jump start by repeating the sentence. It gives me a little bit of a jump start. I'm thinking about, like, what I'm going to say next. So think about, if it's not that technique, there might be something else that you can do to give you a little bit of extra time. Because sometimes that's what you need. It's just a little bit of extra time to think about what you want to say. All right, so who here has experienced imposter syndrome? Yep, a lot of people, a lot of us. I literally just experienced this like 2 days ago. I was at a breakfast roundtable of incredible people. We were talking about compassion in the workplace, and I was looking around the table just sort of in awe of everyone and thinking, like, why am I here? You know, everybody's so amazing and they're all so experienced. And the first time that I kind of came across this concept of evidence-based confidence, which really helps me when I'm in that imposter syndrome mode, I was at Time Inc. We had a new CEO, and he decided he was going to have a meeting for the top 300 managers in the company, and he asked me to speak at the meeting. So there were four people that were going to be speaking at the meeting. And I was very nervous about this because I didn't have a relationship with him yet. You know, he had just started, and I felt like, wow, he's really going to be evaluating me for the first time. Like, I'd never even been in a meeting with him, speaking in front of 300 people. And I was panicking, and I called my coach, this amazing woman, MJ Ryan. I told her how I was feeling, and she said, okay, stop. She said, visualize a time when you gave a great talk, and think about the process that you used to prepare for that, and think about how you felt in that moment and how people looked and how you felt after. And in doing that and going through that process, it gave me the confidence because I felt like, okay, I've done this before and I've done it well. That's evidence-based confidence, right? It's thinking back to a time when you've done something really hard, but you succeeded. So it gives you this sort of confidence that, you know, you can do it again. You can actually apply evidence-based confidence to decision-making as well, especially if you're stuck, if you're in a moment where you're making a big decision and you feel stuck. There are a few questions you can ask yourself. One is, when have you done something difficult and survived? When have you made wise choices? And what process have you used when making successful decisions? This last one is something that you guys can even think about today, like literally, like tonight. You know, think about three really great decisions that you've made over the course of your career, over the course of your life. And think about the process that you use to make those decisions. Like for me, I find that when I take in a lot of data and then I go with my gut, it works. Like that's a process that works for me. There might be a different process for you though. So going back and thinking about what that is, because I don't know about you guys, but like when I have a process or a system, it just makes me feel more confident. Like, okay, this is the process that I use. It works for me. So when we're confident, right, we can, it's just easier to ask for what we deserve and to step up into different opportunities. We all know the stat, right, that women make 80% of what men make. When I was interviewing women for the book, it was heartbreaking. Like, I don't even know what other word to use. Like, I could not find one woman who had actually asked for a raise, or who had asked for more, you know, in their performance review. And what I realized was that part of it was confidence, but part of it was also they were in this people-pleasing mode where they didn't want to make waves. Like, they just felt so grateful that, you know, they had this job, and they were getting paid a decent salary. And I think we really have to have a different dialogue with ourselves. You know, we really do. We have to take, obviously companies have to take responsibility for this, but we each, every single one of us has to take responsibility for this. So I wanted to share just a few techniques that have really helped people. I've had so many women reach out to me that have read the book that have asked for raises and they've gotten them. I just had one woman last week who told me she got a 30% salary increase. She's a product manager based in Silicon Valley, and she's now being paid at market. So just a few techniques. The first one is, if you have the data, the market data of what you should be making, so talking to peers at other companies, talking to recruiters, make recruiters your friends, you know, like take them out to coffee every once in a while. Like they know where the heat in the market is. They know exactly what you should be getting paid because they're hiring for positions like yours. So if you go into the conversation where you're asking for the raise with the data, it gives you so much more confidence and you're more likely to get the raise because your manager is going to be like, okay, she actually did the research. She did the work and she should be paid at market. Know all the levers. So I had one woman who asked for a raise. She didn't get it. But there was this women's network that she wanted to join in, I think it was in LA, and it was a $2,000 annual subscription to join this network. So that was her fallback. So she asked for that. So she didn't get the raise. She got the $2,000 for the subscription. But the other thing that she did was now she put it into her boss's head that she was expecting a raise, you know? And 6 months later, she did end up getting it. But knowing all your levers is really important. Timing it right. You know, if you work for a smaller company, a great time to ask is when they've just gone through a fundraising round. That's a really good time to ask. If you've just had a really big win where you've created an enormous amount of value for the company, that's a great time to ask. And then really owning your value. So the other thing I learned in writing the book is that women tend to negotiate more effectively on behalf of someone else. So if you're negotiating on behalf of your best friend, you're going to do a great job versus like negotiating on behalf of yourself. And the reason for that is because you can objectively see the value that they create and you love them so much that you're really going to go to bat for them. And so I like to say, like, channel this towards yourself. Right? Be objective. Like, stand outside of yourself. Look at all of the incredible value that you create, and love yourself enough that you're going to go to bat. That you're going to go to bat for yourself. So it's one thing to ask for a raise. It's another to step up into a whole new opportunity. This stat just always kills me. So HP did this study, and basically what they found out was that men will apply for a job if they feel they have 60% of the qualifications. Women, of course, what do you guys think? We need to have 100% of the qualifications. So what we do is we look at it, we look at the job description, and we automatically focus on, oh, I've never done that, I don't have that experience, like there's no way that I can apply for this. So, you know, my advice to you is that if you're at least 60% qualified, go for it. And I had this amazing young woman in my life. Her name is Alex. She came to me about 6 months ago, and she said that, you know, look, there's this job at the company, and I'm not quite qualified for it, but oh my God, I really want it, and I don't know what to do. And I encouraged her to go for it, and she did. And I love this quote. She said, even though on paper I didn't have all of the qualifications to get promoted, I figured I had nothing to lose by going for it. The worst case scenario was that even if I didn't get the job, I would get on senior management's radar. So she did end up getting the promotion, which is awesome. But the other thing I want to say about this is the worst case scenario part, right? Even if you don't get it, you're now on senior management's radar. You've now met the hiring manager who you now have a connection with, and hopefully you'll nurture that relationship and ask them for coffee, and maybe there's somebody who could be helpful to you down the road. You know, you've updated your resume, you've brushed up on your interviewing skills. Like, that's the worst case scenario, right? So go for it. You really have nothing to lose. So it's awesome to seize new opportunities. The flip side of that is when you get asked by people to do things that kind of fall outside of your priorities, which this happens all the time to all of us. So I want to tell you it's okay to say no. You can do it in a way that's nice and human and not piss people off. And for me, I really realized this when I came back from my first maternity leave around 8 years ago, and I was feeling very vulnerable. You know, I was feeling like I had to prove that I could do it all. I was saying yes to everything at work. And as you can imagine, like, all of the really important things that I was supposed to be doing were like slipping through the cracks. So it was not good. And what I realized was that I should only be saying yes to the things that matter. And that I really had to change the way that I thought about my priorities and the way that I approached how I do my work. So I created this really simple, like really, really simple model that I've been using for the last 8 years. I call it my four square, because I'm very visual. And what I did was I said, you know, what are the four areas that are the most important to me? And so I came up with me, which is all the self-care stuff, family, career, and world. And by the way, these can be different, right? If you're in school, it might be school instead of career. It might be travel instead of family. But these were my four areas that I really wanted to spend my time in. And then for each one of the areas, I came up with two or three key priorities that I felt were really going to move the needle for me in a meaningful way. So, like, I can tell you back then, I mean, this is probably a few months ago, but back then, 8 years ago, when I was at Time Inc., what I realized was that I needed to spend less time making internal decks look beautiful, because I was like, you know, going to pitch an idea to Martha Nelson, the global editor-in-chief, and I would have this beautiful PowerPoint deck, like all, you know, buttoned up. When I realized I don't need to do that, I can just go and have a conversation with her. It could just be a 20-minute conversation. I don't need to put the deck together. And what I really needed to be focusing on was all of our magazines were aging in a big way. So, like, the median age of a lot of our magazines was like 47, 48. So we weren't getting the millennial audience, which meant we weren't getting the advertising dollars related to those millennials. So I realized that, like, the big thing I needed to focus on was making acquisitions, acquiring digital media companies that would get us that audience. That was number one. Number two, social media was exploding, and celebrities were no longer coming to us to break their news. They were now breaking their own news on Instagram and on Facebook and on Twitter, and this was a huge threat to our business. So those were the two areas that I felt, you know, this is really where I need to spend my time, right? And everything else is just not as important. The other big part of this is every week, usually on a Friday or over the weekend, I look at my calendar and my to-do list, because that's where I'm actually spending my time. And I compare it to my four square to see if there's alignment. And if there isn't, I make changes. Like, I will take meetings off my calendar to create more time in my calendar. sometimes I look at my priorities and I'm like, okay, maybe I need to recalibrate these. But it's really important on a regular basis to kind of look at that. Look at where you're actually spending your time and where you want to be spending your time. I did this exercise with a young woman recently, and we realized she was only spending 25% of her time on her priorities. So she had some pretty big decisions to make, right, about things that she needed to kind of extricate herself from. Okay, so if somebody asks you to do something that falls outside of these priorities, how do you say no? How do you give a kind no, right? So it's four easy steps that I have. They're really easy. So the first is always start by saying thank you, right? You have an opportunity that comes your way, falls outside of your priorities. Start by saying thank you. I'm currently focusing on whatever it is you're focusing on. When I was writing the book, I had a lot of, you know, my day job is I'm a startup investor, and I invest in startups, and I had a lot of founders reaching out to me who wanted to pitch me their business ideas, and I would say, look, I'm currently heads down writing the book, right, because I didn't have the time to take those meetings. Say no, you know, say I will be unable to participate if it's an event or if it's some committee that you're being asked to be a part of or whatever it is, and then wish them the best with whatever, you know, with whatever the project is or the event is. The important thing is keep it really short and sweet. The more information that you provide, the more of a chance there is that they're going to come in and try to find a way to get you to do it. So just keep it really, really short and sweet. So sometimes you want to say no, but you also want to do something that's helpful to this person. Maybe it's strategically important, or maybe they're just somebody that you really care for, you know, and you want to be able to be helpful to them in some way. So there is sort of this sweet spot between yes and no where it's like, I can't do that right now, but here's what I can do. And so for me, going back to the founders that wanted to pitch me their business idea, you know, I would say to take that pitch, it's a 3-hour investment of my time because I have to read the deck ahead of time. I have to get to the meeting. It's usually an hour meeting. Instead of the 3 hours, I might say, I'd be happy to introduce you to a potential investor. And if you write the email for me, you know, I'll forward it on. So I just basically took 3 hours and got it down to 5 minutes, still being helpful, but I'm not doing the full 3 hours. So if you guys remember, the first step of saying no is I said thank you and not I'm sorry, right? I started with thank you. So ironically, this was such a small little part of my book, and it ended up being the most popular part. I mean, Oprah actually had the first excerpt. They got to choose like anything from the book, and this was what they chose to run, which was so fascinating. But so here's the deal. So women tend to apologize more than men do. And I didn't realize that I was doing this until a friend of mine called me out on it when I was working at Time Inc. She said, you apologize all the time. And I didn't realize I was doing it. I didn't believe her. So I went into my inbox and I typed the word, I think I have a slide for this, I typed the word sorry into the search field. And literally like hundreds, if not thousands of emails came back. And I went through and I read every single one of those emails and I was horrified because I was apologizing for the most trivial things. And I was inadvertently putting myself in a position of weakness by doing that. Like, if it took me more than 4 hours to get back to somebody, I'm so sorry it's taken me so long to get back to you. Like, so dramatic, right? And completely unnecessary. So I really made it a priority. I'm like, I have to stop this. This is such a speech weakener. So what I did was I downloaded this plugin called Just Not Sorry. It's a Gmail plugin. And what it does is it alerts you every time you type the word sorry so that you're forced to kind of look at it and say, do I really want to say sorry? And I actually used that plugin for about a year because you guys know how long it takes to break bad habits. I used that for about a year. But still, to this day, I reread my emails all the time. I'm going to ask you all, like, what other speech weakeners besides I'm sorry, like, are there speech weakeners that you find yourself using or that you hear other people using?
I think.
Just. God. Just is such a hard one for me to break. I'd like to tell you something. Yeah. Or like the other ones. I have a few here. You know, I might be wrong about this, but... Or like the question mark at the end, the upspeak, right? So just be aware of these. Just they're you know, it's, I know it's hard. Seriously, just is the one for me that I cannot break. Like, if I put it in an email, because I reread my emails, I'm good about taking it out. Because I'll say, like, just following up or just checking in. But that's a tough one for me. But really, just be aware of these. And if there's one that really stands out for you, the other thing that I did with the I'm sorry one is the woman who called me out on it. I asked her to be my accountability buddy. And if, you know, like, anytime you hear me say I'm sorry and I shouldn't, just do a little nudge. Okay, number 9. So when you're thinking about your career priorities and going back to the Foursquare, please consider building out your network. You know, I know networking is such an overused word, but I've realized how much of a priority this was probably about 15 years ago. I was listening to Pat Philly Crucial. She was the number 2 at Time Warner. And she was talking about her amazing career and how she attributes her success to networking. She said something that actually shocked me. She said that she would do 2 networking meetings every single day. And I remember my jaw just like dropping. So I'm like, how do you have the time, right, to do that 2 every single day? So I just made a commitment to myself that I would do 1 per week, that I would meet 1 new person every single week. And the other thing I did was, you know your why. For me, when I looked up, my whole network was media. It was all media people. And it was really important to me that I branch out into technology and nonprofit. Those were 2 areas I was really interested in. So those were the areas that I prioritized. Also think about, like, if you love where you work right now and you want to stay there for a really long time, it's a great idea to network with people that have powerful positions at the company, right? Or if you're thinking you're probably going to leave in a year, think about people outside the company that you might want to network with. Just like some really specific practices, like, so making a target list of the people you'd like to meet, getting a warm introduction, LinkedIn is great for that. If it's cold outreach, this is where the human part comes in. Express how you can be helpful. I had a young woman reach out to me on LinkedIn. She was brilliant. She said, I'd love to have coffee with you. And I noticed in your portfolio that you have these 2 companies that are really struggling from a social media perspective. I have ideas for you. So I took that meeting because she was going to bring something, right, to the table. Come prepared to the meeting. You guys, don't go to a meeting and just say, you know, tell me about your career. You know, read about the person. Have very specific questions. Show that you've done the work, right? Put the time into it. These are the 2 questions that I think you should ask at the end of every single networking meeting that you do. Is there anyone you think I should meet? And how can I be helpful to you? Those are 2 really good questions. And then afterwards, make sure that you stay in touch with the person. You know, send a thank you note. Maintain the relationship. You went to all this effort to get the coffee with the person. So make sure that you stay in touch with them, even if it's just sending them a link to an article every once in a while, or if they've been promoted, send them a little congratulations note. Stay in touch with them. You know, try to see them once a year. And I'm going fast because I know we're running out of time. This is the last one. Pay it forward. Pay it forward. I already talked about encouraging others to speak up is a great way to do that. Be an accountability buddy, the way that my friend helped me break that horrible habit. Do that for someone else. Ask for more for others. You know, especially women that we know the stats around compensation. So if we can be helpful and ask for more on their behalf, create a mentor circle. So especially for the more senior people in the room who get asked to do a lot of these networking coffees, one of the things that I started doing a few years ago is I will bring 10 to 15 women together at a time. So because I don't have the time to physically meet with every single woman, but like once a quarter, I bring them all together and they get to know me, but more importantly, they get to make these incredible friendships with the other women in the room. So these are my closing remarks. Don't buy into regressive stereotypes of what a successful leader looks like. Bring your whole self to work. You don't have to choose between kindness and strength. And this mindset will make you a better leader and colleague and ultimately contribute to a healthier and more productive workplace culture. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Fran. How incredibly inspiring.
5 minutes.
Motivating and the practical advice is invaluable. I know I speak for the room. We are a little short on time. Fran has generously made all of her slides available in the conference app. I saw all of you writing feverishly, so we have that as a gift from Fran. We have time for a few questions. If you have a question, please make your way to a microphone here in the room. And to kick things off, I will ask the first question, Fran. Wrapping up your 7-month book tour and meeting, interacting with so many people who have benefited from you, from your message, from your book, what are you most proud of as you're wrapping up the book tour?
What I'm the most proud of is how vulnerable women have been. You know, like there have been tears. You know, I've been doing a lot of talks actually at companies for their women's networking groups. And it's always so rewarding when people will like raise their hand to ask a question and they're emotional, they're crying, they're talking about their maternity leave or how scared they are. So I'm very proud of the fact that that I've started this conversation, you know, and that I'm not, a lot of the books out there will encourage you to take on a really tough persona or to be somebody that you're not. And really my message is, and I'm giving you permission to just be yourself. You know, and just bring yourself to work. Bring your empathy and your caring and your compassion and your kindness. Bring all of that to work. It will serve you so well. Don't check those qualities at the door.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you. We have a question here?
I do. So you spoke about trying to kind of encourage other folks to participate in meetings. So if you're somebody who is confident enough to speak up in a meeting, and you want to obviously want to give people who maybe are a little bit more quiet or just need more time to think, what are some suggestions that you can give to try and encourage other women to participate and engage in those meetings?
Yeah, so encouraging other women to participate in meetings. I think in addition to giving them a heads up before the meeting, which I think is really helpful, the other thing that you can do in the meeting is do little breakout sessions so that you give them time to prepare and, you know, and assign leaders so that they have time to prepare what they're going to say. I think that could be another helpful tactic.
Thank you.
Great. Next question.
There. Hi, thank you so much for your talk today. I really like the model you gave about being clear about your priorities when you say, and it's okay to say no. And your four square model was very focused on yourself. But do you have any suggestions for as an organization, we can say no? So, for example, my organization is very flexible in what we will accept to do as our priorities. But we don't have an infrastructure for saying no.
To say no to clients or...
Right, exactly.
Oh, to say no to clients. Yeah, wow. So that's like a big cultural shift that I think would take a lot of work. And it actually starts at the top. You know, any cultural shift really starts with the CEO. They would, I think, really need to buy into it. Unless, are you the CEO?
No, but okay. I do have influence. So.
Okay, so that's what I was going to say. So I would have this conversation with your CEO. I really would, because you guys know it's so frustrating when you're working for a company where like the priorities keep shifting, and like you think success looks like this. Like if we get these three things done, we're good. But then it's like this other thing comes up, and you have to drop all that other stuff. It's really frustrating, and it's really bad for morale. So just from an ROI perspective, seriously, from an ROI productivity perspective, it's a great conversation for you to have with your CEO because it really does start at the top.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Over here.
Hi, Fran. How are you?
Hi.
So one of my biggest pet peeves in the workplace is when men tell women to smile more, stop being so harsh, be less aggressive.
Yeah.
However, whether it's men to women or women to women, but yet if I were to ever say that about a man, you never hear that. Like if a man is direct or aggressive, they're respected more and you almost put them on even more of a pedestal. So I guess what would be, you know, I think it's very unfair. Obviously it's a very inequality. So what would be your recommendation to men to women and then women to women who say being aggressive is bad, being direct is bad, but you would never hear that on the opposite side?
Yeah, look, I think the big thing there is we have all these labels, you know, we have all these labels and they just don't serve us well. They really don't. I had a friend tell me the other day, she's raising money for her business and she had a venture capitalist tell her she smiles too much. Literally, he's like, you smile too much. You're too happy. Like you need to be tougher. You need to be, so it's like you can't win. I really think it's about changing the dialogue so that if somebody were to say that to you...
It happens a lot.
You should. I would actually, like, I would go back and I would talk about why you think it's a strength.
Right.
Like, the fact that you're able to build all these really incredible relationships because of your personality. And you built these relationships, which led to whatever, this deal getting done or that product being launched or, you know, whatever it is. Like engage in the dialogue as opposed to just sort of getting annoyed by it, which is what, you know, we tend to do. It just kind of huffing and puffing. Like, have a conversation. Have a conversation with the person about it. And maybe you can get them to change their mindset.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, final question.
Okay. First of all, great session. Thank you. I have a question is, I'm not like a pushover, but and sometimes, for example, if I'm in a meeting and I would give up an, I'd like my manager to ask a question, I'd say an idea, a colleague of mine, usually a male colleague, would jump in and repeat or like refurbish what I just said, and then it would be kind of claimed as his idea in the end. So how do I like stay nice but kind of like own what I've asked, like what I contributed to the meeting?
Yeah. It's really, it's very important to take credit for your work. It really is. And to do so in a way, like I had this woman, Reshma, who she came up with the name for this new product that they were launching. Like it was a team. They were brainstorming. She came up with the name and everybody decided that was the name to go with. And then someone else went to their boss and took credit for coming up with the name. And Reshma, she's like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And I said, well, what I would suggest is go in, talk to your boss, like have your list of things to talk about, or maybe it's in your weekly one-on-one with him, and just say, I'm so excited. I heard you loved the name that I came up with for the product. Like, you know, say that or make it more into like from a storytelling perspective. I wanted to share with you the brainstorming technique that we were using. You know, it was this associative blah, 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 blah. And when I came up with the name and everybody loved it, it just made me so happy. Like, so you could do it in a way where it's not annoying. You're not like rubbing anybody the wrong way, right? But you're still making it clear that you came up with the name or the idea or whatever it is.
Thank you.
We have to stop there. I apologize. Okay. She's going to be whisked away to her book signing. We encourage you to visit her there and ask additional questions. Thank you, friend. This is wonderful.